Space, the final frontier.
These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission, to explore strange new worlds.
Boldly go where no man has gone before.
Engage.
Engage. Kirk Enterprise, Enterprise.
This is Captain Jean-Luc Picard.
Captain Catherine Janeway.
Captain Sisko.
Red alert.
Photon torpedoes, fire.
The official Star Trek podcast.
Engage. Engage.
Make it so.
With your host, Jordan Hoffman.
That, sir, is illogical.
And make sure history never forgets.
This is Engage.
Hailing frequencies open, sir.
Hello, how you doing, everybody? It is the next episode of Engage, the official Star Trek podcast, and I am your host, Jordan Hoffman. Feel free to tweet at me at @jhoffman or hashtag us at EngagePod. I forget to say these things sometimes. Go to Facebook, facebook.com/Engage, the official Star Trek podcast. Go to iTunes. Oh, for the love of God, go to iTunes and tell them that we're great and subscribe. And do all the things. All right, good. Good, good, good. We got that out of the way. This week's episode is a doozy. It was recorded live at the Jacob Javits Center in New York City. If you've never been to the Jacob Javits Center, it is the size of a skyscraper just laying down. It's a very long glass building that goes on for blocks and blocks and blocks right along the West Side Highway on the water. And there's nothing around it, really. It's kind of a concrete island with a couple of real shady-looking bars and gas stations. And then there is the Javits Center, where on Labor Day weekend 2016, it was the host to Mission New York, the first Star Trek convention in New York City for decades. Particularly great here that it happened on the 50th anniversary because, as you know, at the Ambassador Hotel, which no longer exists, that was where the first Star Trek episode, first Star Trek convention was in 1970. I forget the exact date, and I'm not looking it up because it doesn't really matter. 1970 something was the first Star Trek convention, and now 2016, the most recent at the Javits Center. It was a good time. I was the main stage host for many of the events, not all of them. I sat with the Deep Space Nine cast, which was wonderful because I was so close to my now good friend Nana Visitor. She and I were just locking eyes the whole time. It was wonderful. And just away from her was my good friend Terry Farrell. And when I wasn't looking at Nana, I was looking at Terry. When I wasn't looking at Terry, I was looking at Nana. The dudes that were there, I don't even remember what they said. I was just looking at them. It was a really good time for me. The next gen panel was terrific also. We had Marina. We had Gates. We had Jonathan Frakes and the whole gang. Why am I telling you this? We had the Voyager panel, the Enterprise panel. Dr. Phlox was there running around. It was a good time. And you know what? It's not on YouTube, and you're not going to see it on YouTube, because what's the point of having these conventions if they're just going to be on YouTube? You got to get off your ass and go. That's why we do them. Sometimes we get complaints. Why don't you record the panels? Well, it's not as special if it's just recorded. And certainly we can't prevent somebody in the audience from taking out their iPhone. You know, this is America. We're not gonna throw you out. But it's purposely not put online because it makes going all the more better. And in Vegas, you can fit up to 6,000 people on the main stage. Here at the Javits Center in New York, it's something like 2,500 with standing room. And there was standing room, certainly for Shatner. So it's what you got to do. But there are always exceptions. And two of the exceptions are what's going to be the next two episodes of Engage, the official Star Trek podcast. The first one, today's episode, is a live podcast we did with Armin Shimerman and Ethan Phillips. They said to me, pick two people you want out of all the guests here, and we'll see if we can get them on. And these were the two I picked because I wanted to do something that was particularly angled toward humor on Star Trek, which is something that I think is not as discussed as often as it should be. I have said many times that the thing that really put me over the edge to being a Star Trek fan was Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, which I saw as a kid in the theater, and it was a riotous comedy. It still is. And it was that humor that really drew me in as a very young lad. And humor is part of what made Star Trek Beyond such a success, the Bones-Spock relationship. And going back to TOS, the humor in all of it really was so much of what was important to me. And there's humor in all the shows. I mean, one of the funniest characters, and we're going to get her as a guest soon, so hold on your hats. But Jeri Ryan has yet to be a guest on this show, and we're working on it. The phrase, her people are talking to my people, is actually apt in this case. So Jeri Ryan was going to be a guest earlier. Something fell through. It's going to happen. And I've met her, and she's wonderful. And she is, in addition to all the other things she is, hilarious. And she's hilarious on that show. At least I do. At least I think so. Anyhow, so we had Ethan and Armin on, and they were great. And you know how I know they were great? Because I was there. And you know what? You're going to get to hear it too. So let's shut up about it, and instead of me yapping, let's just kick it back a few weeks. We're in the basement of the Javits. Not a very nice environment. Cold, cinder block with gross lighting. The Javits Center upstairs is divine because it's got lots and lots of glass window, a window, you know, it's a giant window, lots of windows all over the place. You go downstairs to some of the smaller panel rooms, which is where this event happened, and it's like being in a tomb. Nevertheless, that's where we were. So let's listen now to Armin Shimerman and Ethan Phillips from Star Trek Mission New York, Labor Day 2016.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Welcome back to Engage.
Engage.
The official Star Trek podcast with your host, Jordan Hoffman.
You are, after all, irrational.
So welcome to our first ever live podcast of Engage, the official Star Trek podcast. Thank you for coming. But there is something, and I'm thrilled that you're here, and but I did realize something a moment ago. If there's something else going on, you can leave, because this is being recorded. You can listen to this later. You don't actually have to be here right now. But we're glad that you're here, and just for my sake of mine, I'm just going to pretend that the audience is doing what they're supposed to be doing when they're listening to the show. I'm going to envision you washing the dishes, just sort of like riding the bus, you know, doing the things that podcast audiences are supposed to do.
A little like filming an episode, right?
So with me today on my right are two of my favorite Star Trek luminaries and two of your favorites as well. We'll do it even though we've been chatting and you met them already. Let's do a formal introduction. To my right, Mr. Armin Shimerman.
Hey. Cheers.
Toasting you with an empty cup.
And a full cup.
A full cup. And with the empty cup. So you have no coffee right now, Ethan.
I have none. Ethan Phillips, coffee-less.
Ethan Phillips to his right, who had a cup of coffee. Now it's gone. So
we are the tallest actors on Star Trek.
Relatively early in the day, so... you know, without the coffee, if we all fall asleep, that's that. But anyhow, so later in the show, we'll call this a show. We do have a microphone set up if you want to ask some questions, but we'll just pretend that we're doing a traditional podcast. And the reason why I brought these two gents on specifically, other than the fact that that
we're used to getting up early in the morning,
that I love these chaps, is there is something of a theme, which is. Humor in Star Trek. These are two very entertaining and humorous people. And humor has always been a part of Star Trek. In the original series, a lot of it stemmed, I think, from the relationship between Spock and Bones, and also with Scotty, and sometimes with just whatever alien was there that week.
Harvey Mudd.
Right. Oh, Harvey Mudd, absolutely. Cyrano Jones. The whole gang. And what happened with these two characters is over the seven seasons, they evolved. You know, in episode one, it may have been, oh yes, this is clearly the comic relief character. And then by the end of the run, it's like, no, that's really selling it short. So I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit, when you first went out for the role, was it presented to you as quote unquote comic relief? Or was it more like, no, this is just a character and...
and you're going to do it your way?
It's easier for me to answer that question because I had played Ferengi before and had screwed up really badly. The Ferengi were never supposed to be comic, not originally. Hmm. So, but they hired me. That was a mistake. And I actually, my attempt at Quark, my overall arc with Quark was always to make the Ferengi and myself, Quark, more serious, actually. I wanted to be taken more seriously than the comic creatures that had been Ferengi on Next Generation. So it was a gradual path of a little bit more gravitas whenever I could stick it in.
Yeah. Well, I think the evolution came, and I somebody in the audience will know, I forget the exact name of the episode, but when it first clicked with me was, I don't know, you were all somewhere and you were trapped in a cave or something, and it was like, oh, I get it. Star Trek is about respecting all cultures, even a culture that you may think, you know, the Ferengi, they obsess over money, so clearly that's beneath us. It's like, no, that's just what they do, and if that's what they do, and if they're good people, we have to respect that. And
absolutely, and it is about respecting cultures, but Star Trek usually is about that, about going to a new planet. Johnny would know, do I call you Johnny or Ethan?
Ethan.
Ethan would call you, would say that on his show, that they did that a lot, whereas we tended to have the cultures come at us. But it is about respecting other cultures, and eventually they got around to respecting the Ferengi culture as well.
Right. I mean, by the end of the Dominion War, the Ferengi were as crux to everything as anything else. Ethan, was it something that when for season one it was pitched to you as, and you will be the comic relief for this show?
No, they never said that. I never looked at it as a comic relief. I don't even look at it as a character. I look at it as me, because if I was playing a character, I'd be acting. So I don't want to be acting. I've been doing it long enough to know that he was certainly different from the other people, because they're very militaristic and they have a kind of a rigidity being in the military, which is important because you have to follow orders and stuff like that to get everything accomplished. And Neelix did not have that burden on him. And so they wrote to a kind of an emotionality and an exuberance and stuff. They wrote to that. I remember the audition was I wouldn't say it was so much funny, but more it was open and there was a vibrancy and a charm that he had. And I don't think he had a lot of funny moments, but I think he had a lot of moments that stood out because they were so different from the kind of officers on that ship, you know?
Yeah.
He wore his heart on his sleeve and stuff.
Well, I mean, the ship was in a bad spot.
Sure.
The Delta Quadrant, as we know. And Janeway, the character, realized that if she didn't exploit the natural Talaxian goodness in Neelix of, like, this is a guy that can cheer people up, mm-hmm. she's going to have a problem on the ship. Now, you say you don't think of it as acting, you think of it as being you. If you're somewhere, if you're like in an airport and the flight is delayed, do you feel compelled to make everybody around you feel better?
He does. He does.
Not strangers, but...
they have to pay.
They have to pay. No, I have the impulse to entertain and make people laugh. My father had it, my grandfather had it, my sisters have it. It's just part of... the Irish-Jewish background I have. I think that Neelix, he had to really make a place for himself. He had to kind of find a way to be indispensable. So he wanted to be everybody's friend. He wanted to be liked because he didn't want to go back to what he was doing. So he may have gone overboard, you know, trying to ingratiate himself. And I think that dynamic was not always... something that appealed to the entire audience. But he went through some very serious things.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Existential crisis with death and afterlife, recognition that the fact that his, genocide was committed on his, many, many things that gave him the chance to be a grounded, three-dimensional character.
What is that button on your shirt?
That's the Robbie McNeil fan club.
Oh, and what is the T-shirt? It's a button. It's a Robbie McNeil
fan club.
Fan club on a
Robbie McNeil fan club T-shirt.
So you're planning to get those signed later today?
I'm hoping. I'm hoping Robbie will sign them. I have a Cork Armin Shimmerman fan club, but my wife is now using it as a dish rag, so I wasn't able to bring it in with me, which is unfortunate.
It is unfortunate, yes. Luckily, she's out of town right now.
Do you get a price break when you ask for him to sign these things?
He gives me 10% off, which I'm really grateful for.
The first time I saw Ethan at a convention, he was up at a podium speaking, and he said something I've never forgotten. It's one of the... Ethan is very funny. He's very, very funny. But he said this, it's just a great line. He said, you know what's wonderful about being on Star Trek? He said, I can now get Ethan Phillips' autograph anytime I like.
I have over 50,000 copies of my autograph in my house. You know, but I'll tell you the truth. Everybody, you know, laughed when I told them I wanted to be a comedian. Well, they're not laughing now.
One last thing about this man's incredible knowledge. He is an encyclopedia of jokes. You ask him about any topic whatsoever, and he has a dozen jokes he can tell you. And they're not only funny, but his delivery is genius.
It's Tourette-ic. It's very sad. I look at everything and I think, what's a one-liner for that? Rather than how can I help this person? Is there a good one-liner for this situation? It's terrible.
All right, well, let's test this out here. Let's think of a topic. Tomorrow is Labor Day. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know, a guy walks into a bar and he realizes it's Labor Day and?
Well, you want a Labor Day joke?
I want a Labor Day joke.
I don't have a Labor Day joke.
No, nobody, because you're off that day.
Yeah, I have working.
Funny.
I have a guy. I have a guy.
Let him think.
I have a lot of these jokes, but I don't know if I can tell them on the podcast.
I see very few underage people here.
There's one.
Right. Do we have her parental consent? Yes. Okay.
Okay. I'll substitute. It's pretty blue. I'll substitute a word. I can get in trouble for this. No. The only ones that come to mind are things that I could get in trouble for telling.
Okay.
So.
All right. Tell you what. Why don't we, from the audience, think about it, and then later think about a topic that Ethan can concoct and pull out of a hat. Right?
Yeah. This is a great Labor Day joke, but it's unfortunately got.
You want to write it down?
It's got the F word in it.
You want to share it with me?
Okay. Let it. You know, they collaborate. He can.
No.
He can.
I will not step on his lines.
You mentioned a little bit about the Talaxian character. He was a scavenger.
Just don't have another one, and it's got the F word in it. Damn it. Okay. Keep going.
Well, you could say.
This is also a joke that involves. No, I'm going to get in trouble.
All right.
Let's keep going here.
Okay, let's keep going. The Talaxians were.
Oh, yeah. You don't want to talk about that.
But it is about working, so. Sure. Go on.
Talaxians were scavengers, collectors. Are you in your life? Is that something? Do you collect things?
I'm a scavenger. And
I mean, is there like a thing that you're a hobbyist about? I want to collect this, that, and the other thing.
I collected first editions of American fiction from the 20th century
really?
For a long, long time.
That's a nifty. Does he keep it all in the?
Besides being a phenomenal scholar about humor, Ethan is one of the most well-read people you'll ever meet. He's constantly reading novels. He's constantly reading. Besides jokes, you name a novel, he's probably read.
Right. Armin, you're like my publicist. Armin is, I'm going to butter him up. I know a lot of people, and I've done a lot of Shakespeare, 14 productions in my life. I've never met anybody who knows more about Shakespeare than this man, ever, which he teaches.
Including Patrick Stewart.
Yeah, that's quite possible, actually.
No, it's more than possible. I've had enough chats with him, I know.
Okay.
Armin, which is your favorite Shakespeare play?
Oh, I don't have any. It's like Johnny's jokes. I don't have a favorite. I have directed Twelfth Night twice, so perhaps that's a little bit of a favorite. But the truth is, all the plays have something interesting in them, and you just have to dig around for them, and you'll find quite ingenious.
Are there some film productions of Shakespeare plays that you really would recommend to someone who's like, I've never really gotten into Shakespeare?
Yeah.
What's the one they should see?
It's not necessarily a film per se, but you know there's this project where they televise shows for England and they show them in American theaters. About 2 years ago, there was a production of Othello with Adrian Lester and Greg Kinnear. I left that theater saying to everyone around me, I will never, ever see a Shakespearean production ever as good as that production was. It was perfect in every way.
Wow. Where was it done?
It was one of those streaming from London.
Greg Kinnear, huh?
Greg Kinnear, who is on Penny Dreadful. He plays Frankenstein.
Right.
And Adrian Lester, who was one of the great actors of the English theater.
He did that play Red Velvet?
Yeah, he did Red Velvet.
So this is probably something that people could find. If they beamed it over here, it's probably you can get the DVD.
This should be somewhere. Yeah. But that is without doubt. And then, of course, there's the legendary production of Kenneth Branagh's Henry V, which is a brilliant production.
That is a great one. That's almost like an action-adventure film.
A lot of Shakespeare plays are action adventure. They just don't have action adventure dolls.
Did you like Kenneth Branagh's Hamlet?
No.
Can I tell you a story about
that?
Armin and I did a production of Hamlet out in Los Angeles 14 years ago.
Yeah.
And I played, Armin played Claudius, and I played Polonius. And Polonius is normally played as a somewhat doddering kind of guy who's beginning to lose it a little bit. And I very much wanted him to play him like Dick Cheney, you know. I really wanted to avoid that. And but there's a scene in Act Two, correct me if I'm wrong, where he's telling his mate to follow Laertes' behavior in
Paris.
Sending his to spy out on his son. And he has the lines, now I want you, when you get there, to... Oh, where was I? What was I saying? And he says, yes, when you get there, I want you to blah, 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 blah. And then a little later he goes, where was I? And, oh, yes. And it's usually played as a guy who's kind of getting a little dementia, maybe. And it kind of went against the track I wanted to play, which was a guy who was really on the ball. And I wasn't sure how to do this scene, given the architecture I was trying to build for Polonius. And they cut the scene, which is normally cut, correct? And so I didn't have to worry about it. So I'm watching Kenneth Branagh's Hamlet, and they've got this guy playing Polonius, and he's doing them like Ehrlichman or Haldeman. I mean, he's really steady and smart. And I say, I wonder what he's going to do when he gets to the scene, if they keep it in. And they kept the scene in, and this is what he does. He goes, and when you get to Paris, I want you... Where was I? What was I saying? I.e., are you listening to me? And he did that the second time. He said, Where was I? To make sure that the guy was listening to him. I thought, well, that's an example of how you can make choices about lines to support your interpretation of the character. I always thought that was a great lesson.
Yeah. It's almost like jazz. I mean, it's like you have the structure, and then you can riff, and you can kind of do it your own way.
And all acting is like that. No matter what part you're in, whether it's TV or film or commercials or whatever, you choose the actor for several reasons, but one of the reasons is how they interpret the role. If the director wants to see Johnny play Polonius that way, he'll choose Ethan because of that. And whereas if I want to play it a different way, he won't choose me. And in fact, going back to the original question very quickly, Max, who was the runner-up for Quark, who played Ron.
I didn't know that name.
Yeah. We sat outside the Paramount building and we discussed our auditions, and Max said he knew of the Ferengi's comic character, so he had approached Quark as a comic character. And I said, oh, that's not the way I saw it at all. I saw him as a very serious character. And and so when the choosing came, perhaps the difference was that Max was a phenomenal actor, after all ended up to be the Negus. saw it one way, I saw it another way, and the people that were deciding, who were doing the casting, decided, okay, that's the choice we want as opposed to that choice.
Yeah, it's very much like if, when you get into the audition room, the casting director chooses actors that she knows can do the job. So she brings in 10 or 100 actors, and they're all capable of it. And it's like she's showing the director a box of crayons, and she's saying, look, this is a dark purple, and this is next we have a light purple, and here we have a medium purple. And the director looks, and they're all great colors, and they're all really good, but the lead is a dark orange. And they go, you know, I love the light purple, and he's fantastic, but we really need a dark purple for this. So when you don't get the role, it's not necessarily because you screwed up. You go and you do your best, but the results are out of your hands. It's like the director is painting a picture, and he wants, I want a bald guy for that who's shorter than the lead, you know, so you just give it up to the gods. And I was in the right place at the right time. They really wanted the guy who had my kind of personality, or my kind of rhythms and my kind of, you know, pace and everything like that. And also, I think they were just exhausted. They'd been looking at like 700 people. And it was towards the end of the cast.
I was already out of the question. So.
No, and he was out of the question. Picardo auditioned for my role. And very much like Max, did a much different kind of interpretation than I did.
Do you know what his interpretation was?
He told me
was?
He made him a much sterner and manipulative. I'm sure he did a brilliant job, but I don't think they wanted to go that way. You know?
No, Neelix is all honest. He's all on his sleeve. He's not manipulative at all. You, on the other hand, are. No. So, I'll save that question for later. Okay, everybody wants to hear yet again about the makeup that you wore. But my question is this. In an attempt to try to think of a question you haven't been asked about the makeup 7,000 times, I'm curious about this. Obviously, they do the tests on the first day. They work on your head, and they get it. They take photographs. They film you. They do this, that, and the other thing. And then they say, we think we got it. And then it's the first day of shooting. They put it together. What I'm wondering is, you guys are both trained actors. Was there a time where they left you alone with the makeup for like some time to get used to it, because it does inform the character a bit? I mean, the ears, the teeth, the whole nine yards. Did you get any of that, or was it like, we got the makeup and you're on stage in 3 minutes?
We got the makeup. We're on stage in 3 minutes.
Before I played Quark and I played Ferengi, that was the case. We got the makeup and you're on, and they had screwed up, and it's well. Most of the Ferengi have veils in the back.
Right.
It's not because it's any choice. It's because when I was made up, they went, oh, the clothes don't go all the way up to the back of the head. And I had to be on stage in 3 minutes. So they went and got a piece of material and a stapler gun. And I heard this, thinking that's what they're doing in the back of my head. And that's why the Ferengi wear veils. It's not because it was a choice. It's because you had to be on stage in 3 minutes and we had to cover up the gap. But for me, because I had played Ferengi before and I knew the difficulties of the makeup, I told Michael Westmore, the brilliant creator of all the makeups on Star Trek, I said, I need certain things. If I'm going to do this for 7 years, I need certain things in the makeup so that I can withstand it. Because when I started playing Ferengi, the Ferengi makeup was right up against the head. So I had large ears. That's probably why I got cast. And so what happened was they pinned me in like this, and they were laid flat against my face for 16 hours. And that was painful. After about 10 hours, that was enormously painful. And so I said, you have to create pockets for my ears. And they did, which resulted in my head, my Quark head was the largest Ferengi head on the set.
Which is powerful, too.
Yes. Now, tell them about our competition for years about who had the worst makeup.
Well, that's common among all prosthetic actors. You know, they're always going, you know, mine's worse than yours, you know. I didn't know Neelix was a makeup character. When I auditioned for him, they described him as a humanoid, which I don't know enough about Star Trek, so I thought it was a guy who had like an oid hanging from his head. It's an oid. But it wasn't until I was cast that they said, you're gonna have to come in and have a makeup cast done. And that was cool, you know, I don't mind. I didn't really see the makeup until it was literally applied. And even then I didn't see it because I'm blind as a bat. And they gave me the prosthetic, the yellow contact lenses. I put them in, and that's the first time I saw Neelix. And I went, wow, that's a beautiful, beautiful job. It really very well done. And it had Neelix's temples are yellow, and when it was first done, they were pink, and we had to go to Rick Berman, and Rick Berman said, "No, it looks too much like a wound. Make them yellow." So they changed. That was really the only change they did.
Really?
Yeah.
But for years, Ethan and I would say, "Oh, yours is worse. No, yours is worse. No, yours is worse." But eventually, Ethan got to play a Ferengi.
Well, I had actually played one before on the Next Generation, yeah. So I knew yours is warmer.
Yeah.
Yours is warmer because it's thicker, but mine is stickier because there's several pieces that go on.
And so, you have the contact.
And the context, and it's so mine is a lot harder to remove. Mine took an hour and 20 minutes to remove at the end of the day.
And mine took an hour.
Yeah. So it's none of it's pleasant. Just go home, put a mattress on your head for a day, and you'll kind of see what it's like. You know.
That's the worst part is like you're done with a grueling day, and I know that some of these production schedules were nuts. You were working, and then you were doing reshoots on all this stuff in second unit, and then everybody gets to go home, and you have to sit for an hour.
But you, believe me, you want to, because if they don't take it off properly, your face will bleed.
Oh.
So they have to use a very dense product called isopropyl myristate, which is a one of the things that goes into makeup, and it detacks, whereas alcohol would just like dissolve, but it would dry your skin, and they would do that process with guest stars because they didn't give it about their faces.
Right.
You know, I remember guys coming in, you know, and at
is
the
that
end.
A Labor Day joke.
No, but thank you. That's my Labor Day joke. But they'd come at the end of 5 days, they'd be bleeding, and they go, "How come you're not bleeding?" I said, "I'm a regular."
It's in the contract. I'm not supposed to bleed all over the place.
If you get real close to Michael Dorn and look right here, there's still, I believe, still there, slight pigmentation loss in his skin, where his beautiful black face, there's little tiny marks of white where he literally, from all the years of pulling off his makeup, which he did by himself, which he was told not to do. And that's Michael all over. But he would tear it off, and he literally pulled the pigmentation out of his skin.
Oh my God.
Wow. He's 11 seasons as Worf. There's, yeah. You're gonna wanna tear it off, 11 seasons.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
This is Engage.
Engage.
The official Star Trek podcast.
Energize.
Well, you know what? We do have some time for some audience participation. This is like a smaller crowd, a more mellow crowd. If anybody has any questions, which is something we don't normally do on the podcast because there's not usually people in the studio. We have one brave soul. He's going to ask for a Labor Day joke or maybe a different holiday joke. Why don't you go ahead, sir?
My question is for Armin. Coming back to a point from earlier on in the discussion about the arc of the Ferengi, you know, as we said, there was sort of a development of the human characters learning to accept the Ferengi, and that maybe their sort of high-minded 24th century ideology was not fully realized. Was that an intentional choice by the writers, or was
no.
that something where the actors were saying, "Hold on a minute, you know, you've created this show about a scenario in which humans get along with everybody, but we're treated like the comic relief," and sort of, you know, in some ways internalizing the writer's kind of 20th century ideology and not fully sort of developing that out to what it should have been?
Thank you. You've answered my question. but it's exactly true. I don't think they intentionally meant to do that. I've written a novel called The 34th Rule, which deals with that, which is that it was subconscious. I think they saw humans as the ultimate being, and then perhaps underneath that are Vulcans. And then they, in their own minds, made races sort of hierarchical, each one more advanced than the next. We, the Ferengi, being somewhere at the bottom. And it is why, and so I think as they watched my performance and Max's performance and Aaron's performance and Jeffrey's performance and Ethan's performance, they began to respect the culture a little bit more. As I've always said, in my defense of the Ferengi are the most moral race on Star Trek because, you may find that hard to believe, but they do have a code of ethics. They do believe in, and for the most part, except perhaps for Rom, they try to adhere to that. And it is their code of ethics. And they are following their culture. It may not be your culture. It may not be the culture that you're used to. You may frown upon that culture. But it is their culture. And they do their, my character did his best to be religious.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's funny that the Ferengi will, you know, they'll scurry out of a deal,
but not necessarily.
Well, they'll do it in a way that like there's the right way to do it and the wrong way to do it. Like I feel like if you just make profit, but you do it in a way that is, you know, antithetical to the, you know, the rules of acquisition, then that's just then you might as well not have done it.
That's right. Yeah. There are correct ways to do it. The goal is to make profit. And I venture to say there isn't anybody in this room or anyone listening to this blog who doesn't want to make a profit. You may not want to do it in the way the Ferengi do it, but there isn't anyone here who doesn't want to make some money. If we didn't, we wouldn't be sitting up here on the dais. So it's just a matter, it's the great thing about Star Trek, we all know this. They are fables about investigating our own humanity and what we think about and readjusting ideas, tenets that we believe in and asking the question, do you really believe in it? Is it really the way you see it? Or is it possible, given a conundrum, that perhaps you might go in a different direction, that you might think about an alternate answer? And we don't give alternate answers, we just pose the questions. So that's what we're doing.
Why don't we go to this side here?
We really appreciate you guys being here. I think a lot of folks don't give you guys enough acting credit because of the makeup, and I think a lot of non-Trekkies don't give you guys the credit that you deserve for all the acting that you do. So I just want to throw that out there. Those of us who are actors on a more amateur level definitely appreciate that. But my question actually is mainly for Ethan. I wanted to know, what was it about Benson that we all grew up watching that turned to be such a proving ground for Star Trek? Both you and Renee came out of that show and went on to be Star Trek legends. Mr. Auberjonois had his own makeup issues as well. But it's kind of funny, both characters. I grew up watching both you guys as a kid.
There is the primordial soup. All comes from Benson.
It all is weird. And then if there's a cool Benson story you could throw in, because there aren't Benson.
Well, it's interesting because Dede Khan was cast as Quark's mom, but couldn't do it because she couldn't tolerate the prosthetics.
Neither could Adrian Martin.
And Adrian Martin had to leave, too. It's not everybody can deal with that makeup. A lot of people can't do it because of claustrophobic issues. I think it was a coincidence that we both ended up, a very funny coincidence, but I think Star Trek is a very heavy dialogue show. I mean, there's a lot of action in it, but their dialogue is precious, and they're very proprietary about it. And people like Renee and myself and Armin and all those people on Star Trek have come from a theater background where we have to be
Shakespeare straight.
We have to keep, we honor dialogue, we honor the writer, and we try to make what they give us, work for them, because the playwright is always the beacon. Whereas some shows, which I've done a lot of, they encourage you to improvise, make it your own, you know. But in Star Trek, you couldn't do that. If you wanted to add a new word, they called the writer's building, and you had to wait. Because so I think because of our theater background, it just happened to be part of that. But, and that's not to denigrate anything about any other kind of acting, but Star Trek did usually choose theater actors for their roles.
Any funny Benson stories?
This guy loves Benson. He wants to hear more about Benson.
Just one.
I think he just wants to hear the theme song.
He doesn't have a Benson story, but he has a great Labor Day joke.
No, you know, when we started Benson, Captain Crunch was just a private, okay? I remember because we started the first week, and history was not a subject yet in school. I can't remember the funny. Oh, the funniest thing, the only thing I remember about Benson is I'm a gum chewer. I chew gum all the time. And right, you know the kitchen? Do you remember the kitchen? And that's where everything happened in the kitchen. And in fact, when a show's over, you take something from the set?
You do.
You know? Well, from Star Trek, I took something.
You took the entire Star Trek, yeah.
I took Jerry Ryan. And shit. What? No. I took a little bowl, and from Benson I took some. They had this jar in the back of the kitchen that had cereal in it, and I took some of the cereal. And still have it. But
Benson O's, they were called.
Right before I'd go on, I'd take my gum out and I'd stick it on the flat that was the back of the kitchen. I'd go on. After 5 years, there was a huge gum tree that I had created. And Missy loved it. She just loved the gum tree. And she said, you know, and it had branches. And then I started putting magic marker to it. It was a tree made out of gum that was colored. And that's a little unique Benson story. Nobody knows. We'll give it a shot.
Well, you know, you were talking about dialogue on Star Trek. If I'm not mistaken, you guys didn't have too much of the quote-unquote techno-babble or trekno-babble.
Techno-babble.
You managed to avoid that, but not you had some of it. I mean, there must have been a couple of days. Were some of your colleagues complaining about it and saying you lucked out, you don't get to do any of that? And then the day that
even tried, we'd say, hey, how many hours are you in the makeup chair?
And then there had to have been a few occasions where you did have to sink your teeth into some of the techno babble.
Both sets of teeth, yes.
What were those experiences? I mean, was that a different skill set you had to use to say, oh, now I see why they're complaining, because this is rough stuff.
Well, it's like just you had to put a little more memorization effort into it, because the thing with technobabble is that you have to remember that you still want something. You're still trying to communicate something. You have a need. You have an action. You're trying to change the person you're talking to. Just because it's medical or technological doesn't hide the fact that you're still a creature who is. I always ask, why is the guy still in the room? Why hasn't he left? That's the actor question I always ask. How come he hasn't left the room? Because he still wants something. So regardless of what the language is, you have an action to perform. So it's just a little bit more memorization, that's all.
Have either of you had a chance to see the latest Star Trek movie that's still in theaters?
I have not seen it.
The new movie, and listeners of the podcast know that I'm a big fan of it, even though I was a little suspect of the second one, has the best technobabble scene in all of Star Trek. It's right at the end. Every character, the way Simon Pegg and Doug Young wrote the script and Justin Lin directed it, every character, you know, everybody saw it, you know the scene, it's right before the music. And every character has to say something ridiculous. We have to re-quantify the phaser mix of the blah, 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 blah. And the camera zooms in on their face, and then another one turns, and it's cut together like a dance, and then they go. I don't know what the hell they're saying, but somehow I know, somehow it makes sense they're going to push a button and go boom, is what it is. But the way it's done, and I think it's Simon Pegg, who was a fan first and became a writer for Star Trek as a dream, said, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do this to the 10th degree, and it's a marvel. So
that's great. Yeah.
If you get around to seeing the third Star Trek film, when you get to the end, you're going to see something special that I think as actors you'll get a kick out of. On this side.
Hey guys, thanks for coming. Appreciate it. My question is, so if your two characters had met, what would their relationship be like?
I would have taken him for everything he was worth.
Maybe Neelix was a scrap dealer. He's maybe not as easy as you'd think.
Yeah. Easy enough.
I think we'd... it depends on what the writers would write. Should we improvise a scene?
Sure.
Yeah.
Quark. I've seen you before.
Yeah. Bye.
Wait. Let me offer you a drink.
You didn't.
Half price.
On this side, sir.
Hi. Before you mentioned about bringing a lot of your own personality to the character.
Did we say that?
Interpreting. That's what I heard. But it made me think of one of my favorite scenes, one of my favorite episodes, The Magnificent Ferengi. Where you, at the end, there's a scene, the part where you and Quark and Nog chuckle about, there's a Vorta walking through a wall and he's like, can someone shut him off? I don't know if you remember
Iggy
that
Pop.
Particular scene. Yeah, well, yeah. That seemed, not that you were breaking character, but it seemed very natural. It was like a very off the cuff, you were laughing, it, like almost you couldn't contain it. And I always wondered about that scene because after talking to you briefly yesterday, it sounded, maybe I was like, that's just Armin, that's not the character. So do you,
well, the Magnificent Ferengi, for Ethan who doesn't know, and probably some of you who don't know, was a episode with, I believe there were five, perhaps six Ferengi all together. I am by nature not that funny, but I love other people who are funny. And I had five other Ferengi who were very funny guys.
Who were they?
It was Jeff Combs.
Right.
It was Max Gudenchek. Mm-hmm. It was Aaron Eisenberg. Mm-hmm. It was Hamilton. What's Hamilton? He's passed away now. Hamilton.
Doesn't matter. He's dead. Go on.
And and there was one other one I can't remember. He was one of the original Ferengi on Next Generation, and they were enormously hilarious. So I spent most of that episode guffawing, just laughing. And the moment I stepped off camera, I had to stifle because you can't make a noise when the shot is still going on. But as soon as it was over, I would be in hysterics, doubled over. It's funny to see a Ferengi doubled over. So it's very likely that that take was after one of those takes, and I was just having a good time. When you feel comfortable enough, you can do that. You wouldn't do that in your first year because you're terrified they're going to fire you. But I think that's like fifth or sixth season or something like that. And by that time, I was pretty comfortable with the role and could indeed be myself more often.
It was a great scene, and it worked so well there. So that's just popping in my mind when you were talking about that.
Well, thank you.
Well, Armin, there's something you should know. In Las Vegas a few weeks ago, we did a panel where we, because for the 50th anniversary, we've done a lot of top 10 lists with fans. We're doing one tomorrow morning, actually. And we decided to rank the top 10 episodes of all of Star Trek, all Next Generation, original series, and Magnificent Ferengi came in at number 10.
Wow, great.
And that
wow.
was a surprise because it's not that well known.
No.
But there were some fans, fans come up and they advocate for it, they argue. It's like talking before the Supreme Court. And the person who nominated it gave it a very good argument of why they should, and everybody was like, yes, we need that in there. And I think one of the things that I personally love about that episode, and a lot of other episodes, listeners of the show know that I can't shut up about the Lower Decks from season 7 of TNG, is because I love the characters so much. And I think about the characters a lot. I think about the world of Star Trek. And part of me always wants to know what's going on when it's not the big event, you know?
And it's not Starfleet.
Right, not Starfleet. Like, yeah, you know, Picard's in the center seat doing something major, but what's happening, you know, three doors down? And to a certain degree, that episode answers that because it's a lot of the characters that, well, Deep Space Nine is...
Different.
Yeah, all about that. The giant Russian novel in space, as I like to call it.
I love that analogy, by the way. Hamilton Camp, by the way. Hamilton Camp.
Cool. On this side, yes, we have a question.
For Star Trek Voyager and Star Trek Deep Space Nine, how you had Captain Sisko, Captain Janeway, comparing the two, which do you think was a better captain and why? And who, if you were in Starfleet, who would you rather serve under and why?
Who would you rather serve under for fun or to get you home because there's like problems? Like who's a more effective captain or who's a like, oh, my boss is a jerk, I want this other guy?
Stuff that'll keep you alive.
Okay, so you're stuck, the intergalactic excrement is hitting the fan. Who do you want to be your captain?
Well, first, I want to say of all the podcasts I've ever done, this is the most recent. When I look out at this audience and I think, you know, I realize I left more people than this in bed.
Does Patty know that?
No. I suspect that I would want to serve under Captain Janeway because I don't know who the hell the other captain is. I've never met him. Why would I trust somebody I've never met? So you can work with this person that for the last 7 years has taken care of you in the ship, or this other guy who you've never met. And I'll go, well, I'll go with the guy I never met. No. So to just be logical about it, that would be the way I'd go.
That is a logical answer.
But then also, I think that just to push for feminism, as Iceland did years ago, they made sure that every corporation has to have at least 40% women to balance out the kind of decisions that they come to. And looking at the world today and seeing the state it's in and the fact that mostly it's because of men, I would say I'd like to serve under a woman. I have five sisters. I grew up with seven women in my family, no men. And I just adore women. And I would much rather work under her. I'm not trying to push any agenda. That's my feeling.
Let me preface my remarks by saying, what did you call Kate on the show as far when you addressed her?
Captain.
No, that's the character. What did you, Ethan, call?
Katie.
Katie, okay. We called him Mr. Brooks. So there's a gravitas there. Now, that said, Deep Space Nine was a different Star Trek. We did not have a ship for the first 3 or 4 years. They only gave us the Defiant because the brass upstairs was upset that we didn't have a ship. So I would serve under Sisko, certainly. But if someone was in trouble, I think I'd take the more experienced captain. It was an enormous honor to work with Avery Brooks. He is, as many of you have seen him at conventions, he is a force of nature. He's a force of nature. Incredible human being who doesn't necessarily think linearly, which makes it difficult sometimes. But he is a force of nature, and you heard at our panel that ours was a quiet set compared to Next Generation or even to Voyager. And as I believe Terry said, the atmosphere on a show is dictated by number one on the call sheet, which is the captain. And Mr. Brooks dictated a certain attitude on our show.
Before we were really starting to run out of time. Before we go to more questions, I do want to ask, what's going on new? What do we have to look forward to? We're at the end of 2016. We're going to 2017. Projects that you're working on, theater projects, film, television, video game voiceovers. What's
I'm in a movie that's in the theaters now called Purge 3.
You're in Purge 3?
I am in Purge 3.
I didn't see Purge 3. Purge 2. Purge 1. Purge 2 was actually, of the two that I did see, was a little bit better, I thought, which stands to argue that Purge 3 is the best.
Purge 3 has made tons of money, and it cost, like, not hardly anything, so I guess it's doing pretty well. I play a bad guy, which is fun, because I never get to play a bad guy. I am recurring on a show called Girls. I've done, like, 5 episodes of Girls. I just did a show this week called Younger. Everybody heard of Younger?
Not for years.
Not for years, I haven't heard that word.
Is there going to be a crossover between Younger and Girls? And
I don't think so. It's a different network, TV Land and HBO. I just did a Good Wife a couple of months ago. And
does Patty know about this?
She was fun. I've done Bad Wives too. God, what a setup artist you are. You know, it's been great. We moved back to Manhattan and about 4 years ago, and I've been working here in different kinds of projects than in Los Angeles. I was in Woody Allen's film last summer and worked with the Coen brothers and Llewyn Davis, and been doing a lot of theater in New York.
Ethan was on Broadway doing
All the Way,
Johnson, All the Way,
which
there.
We won the Tony for. So I've been very, for a short, bald guy who can't sing or dance, I somehow have been able to make a living out of this, and it shocks me every day.
You know, you mentioned Benson before. There is a weird thing going on right now with the Coen brothers, who are probably the greatest living American filmmakers right now, and Voyager, because, I don't know, I guess maybe you don't know, so you were in Inside Llewyn Davis, which is a masterpiece.
I think it's their greatest film.
In fact, the BBC just did a poll of the best films of this new century, and Inside Llewyn Davis came in at number 11, I believe.
True, really?
Or in the top 15, to be sure.
Wow. It's a brilliant movie.
And he plays a key. If you haven't seen Inside Llewyn Davis, it's definitely a masterpiece, and he's terrific in it. and play a very poignant part. He plays a Columbia professor whose son recently died, and a lot going on, a period piece set in the early 60s. And then earlier this year, a movie which did not do that well at the box office called Hail Caesar, starring George Clooney, which was very, very funny. And did anybody see it? So, you know, do you remember the scene? Do you know who plays the rabbi?
Robert Picardo.
Robert Picardo plays a rabbi and kills. And I went and saw it.
It's all that Catholic upbringing.
Right. I, my main gig when I'm not talking to Star Trek is I'm a film critic, so I got to see it early, and, you know, his name was not, he's only in one scene, so we didn't know. And I'm sitting there, and I've got my film critic hat on, and then all of a sudden I'm like, holy shit, it's the doctor. What's
the
going on?
The geek hat goes on.
The geek hat goes on, exactly. And so it stands to reason the next Coen Brothers film has to have a Voyager member.
Huh?
Unless they want to switch and go Deep Space Nine, and then Armin's right here.
So. They're not going to go in my direction.
So, Armin, tell us what's happening in your world, projects.
Well, primarily I've gone back to the theater, and recently I just was in Arizona for 2 months playing Tolstoy in a three-hander.
That's the thing you did at the Geffen?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was great fun. I primarily, as I said, gone back to the theater. I helped run a theater in Los Angeles, which is doing quite well. It's called NTS. You'll see the hat on my head when I can find it again. That's what I do. I have just done a small film with Mano Intarimi called The Fifth Passenger, where I get to play a good guy, which I never get to play. Wow. So that was really nice. I'm not allowed to tell you the project I just did 4 days ago, but the title does have Star in it.
We're very curious. Did you sign a non-disclosure thing?
Yeah, I did.
Well, there's another Star franchise.
There is another Star.
Star Wars.
Yeah. Awesome. We have three guys standing. We'll do lightning round, because then we got to go. But very quick lightning round for the guys, because they're standing. And standing here, we'll let them ask their question real quick. You, sir.
Yeah, hi. My question's for Armin. Well, first off, I want to say I didn't know this was you at first, because I didn't know what you looked like without the makeup. I liked you as
Kramer. You never watched Buffy?
No. I liked you. I liked you as Kramer's golf caddy. And also, well, this is, I love this episode, Far Beyond the Stars. I remember you were talking about makeup. Like, I'm sure there were times where you were used to the makeup because you wore it so long, and at the same time, you felt that, at the same time, you probably were relieved when you got off, when it was off. The episode, most of you guys are without the makeup, and you, Rene Bijamon, everyone. How did you have a mix? Like, was there part of you that was relieved to be out of the makeup, but at the same time you missed it?
Well, I spent most of my life out of makeup, so it wasn't a surprise. I remember the crew was working with, and this was late, I think it's the sixth season, and I remember several of the crew members saying to me, Armin, it's really bizarre to work with you when you're not in your makeup. So for them it was, but for me I went, yes, there was relief. And speaking of Far Beyond the Stars, just a little plug, that is without doubt my favorite Deep Space Nine. I think it's one.
It's not only a great acting, a great opportunity for you all to strut your stuff, it's just a great concept. It's far out sci-fi, you know?
It's part of the genius of our writers.
Yeah. On this side, real quick.
All right, yeah. I just want to bring it back to Shakespeare real quick. If you can compare your Star Trek character to a Shakespeare character, what character would that be?
That's a good question.
I'd say Flavius in Timon of Athens. The first one to come to mind.
I'm not knowledgeable enough to know if you're. I can't peer review that. So.
I never thought that's a great question. The first thing that popped to mind was for some reason.
Polonius.
No, not Polonius. Falstaff.
Oh, good.
I don't know why I thought of him, because he's very exuberant and expansive.
That's good.
And
everything, yeah.
So, he comes to mind. But also maybe probably Toby Belch. I would think.
For Twelfth Night, why?
Because he's He's very broad. I'm thinking of the bigger guys, the guys who have a lot of personality and lay it out there. And Toby was certainly like that. Although when I played Toby, I realized this is not the role. That's Ague Cheek, and that's unfortunate.
Ague Cheek is the
role. Yeah. But in any event, those two are the first that come to mind. But I could, if I put on my thinking cap, I might come up with something more specific. It's a good question, though.
The one that's often given, and so I'll give it to you now because it comes to mind readily, is Shylock. Mm-hmm. Not so much because he's Jewish, that's not really important. But as I said yesterday, it's because he's the outsider. Mm-hmm. And all the Venetians don't know what to do with the outsider. They hate him because he is an outsider. Mm-hmm. I don't think the people hated the Ferengi, but there wasn't a lot of love there either. So so I would say Shylock.
Hmm. Thank you. Good question.
That was a good one. It's all on you. You got to follow up. So,
It's actually another Shakespeare question. I didn't, because I never
the Shakespeare con.
I didn't realize that you guys were both so into it. And Armin, you're always going to be Principal Snyder to me. And so I got to ask you, what were your thoughts on Joss Whedon's Much Ado About Nothing?
Yeah.
Well, it was very brave. because it was all done in his house, so that's quite brave. Some of it was quite good, but his premise that Beatrice and Benedict had been lovers at one time, and you know, the film starts with him getting out of bed. I found that a little really Joss. It's not. I was asked earlier what some of my favorite Shakespeare films are. I like it, but I wouldn't put it anywhere near the top of my heap. But God bless him for doing it.
And when you say he shot at his house, I mean, I think it was while he was cutting The Avengers on his off hours. It was like a side project, and then he got his friends together. And
what Joss had a group of people, of which I was never invited to, and I miffed at that. But he had a group of people who used to come to his house on a regular basis, and they would discuss the play, and they would work on the play. And eventually, I guess somebody suggested, why don't we shoot a play? And that's how the movie got made.
Yeah. Hmm. All right, cool. Well, listen, I want to say thanks to our guests right here. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And for those of you who continue to listen to the podcast, thank you for doing so, and tell all your friends, and tweet the hashtag #EngagePod, and like us on, you know, all the, like us on Facebook, like us on others, so just like us, just walk around just liking everything you see, and tune in again next week, because we'll have more good stuff. Thanks again to Armin and to Armin right here. Armin has one point he has to make.
If we shadows have offended, think but this, and all is mended, that you have merely slumbered here while we visions did appear. And of this weak and idle theme, no more yielding than a dream. Come, take my hand if we be friends, and Robin shall make all amends.
All right, folks, that's going to be it for us today. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much, Armin Shimerman, and your Shakespearean recitation, and Ethan Phillips for your dirty jokes. Now, he did whisper the joke to me that he didn't tell on stage. Now, here's where it comes to it, engaged listeners. I will tell the joke the next time we do our next recorded podcast, which is not the next one you hear, because we're going to be banking something else. So that means 2 weeks from now, I will reveal Ethan Phillips's filthy joke if... what should I make you do? What should I make you do? If at least 100 listeners tweet something with the Engage Pod hashtag. All right? If 100 of you do it, anything, a picture, a declaration of love, a meme, something a Spock, something a Quark, whatever the hell you want. If 100 of you, I'm going to count. If we get 100, and that's not a lot. Only 100. If 100 of you do it, I'll tell you the joke. He didn't tell me I could, but he didn't tell me he couldn't either. Okay, thanks so much for listening, and we'll get you next time. Until then, live long and prosper.